Good evening, everybody. So glad you're here tonight. I can't imagine that this topic would draw any interest. It's never in the news, never the subject of discussion, no commentary anywhere, anytime. It's, on the other hand, it's not exactly one of those forgotten amendments, is it? In fact, if you think about the amendments in the news, what part of the Constitution is the subject of more discussion these days than the Second Amendment? So I'm very happy you're here tonight. I want to encourage you to ask all the kinds of questions that interest you. And I think we're going to have a very full discussion over the next hour and a half. So let me remind you before we get started tonight that if you're interested in the subject, the Japanese internment during World War II, I'm going to be giving a talk at the Idaho Falls High School next Monday at 6:30, 6:30 to 7:30 in the Little Theater, and it's a freebie. It's hosted by Idaho Falls High School, so I hope you'll all come out and enjoy the free talk. But you're going to get what you pay for, just so you know. So tonight's topic, then, is one that rivets the attention of the nation on those very interesting words in the Second Amendment. Quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Let's consider all the controversy that this clause of the Constitution has raised, but let's understand that the controversy is of recent vintage. Because if you go back 10 years ago, nobody was raising questions about the meaning of the Second Amendment until the Bush administration, led by then Attorney General John Ashcroft, suddenly pivoted and changed the interpretation of the Second Amendment from the standpoint of the U.S. Department of Justice, for the first time in our history, asserting that the Second Amendment protects individual rights. That determination by the Justice Department helped to pave the way for the Supreme Court's decision in 2008 in District of Columbia versus Heller, in which the court engaged in what we call conservative judicial activism to put a spin on the meaning of the Second Amendment to overturn nearly 200 years of precedence. And to put that in perspective, let's understand a key point. From 1791, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, until 2008, no law had ever been held in violation of the framers' perception of the Second Amendment. That is to say, the framers' intention had been that the meaning of the Second Amendment promotes the right of individuals to keep and bear arms for purposes of belonging to a militia. That had been the steady view of the Second Amendment from the time it was written until 2008 when the Heller decision came down. How to make sense of all this? The great Athenian philosopher Aristotle said, if you would understand anything, study its origin and development. So that very wise biologist turned political scientist, in case you're wondering, the first political scientist ever, will provide guidance for us tonight as we begin to examine the origin of the Second Amendment by turning the clock back a few years to, let's say, 1328. Is that a good year? We'll just go back 700 years tonight. 1328 was important because it represented the first statute enacted by Parliament governing the right of people to keep and bear arms. that phrase wasn't used. That phrase would not be developed for another 450 years. But in the Statute of Northampton, enacted during the reign of Edward I, Parliament passed a law that prohibited people from carrying weapons down the streets, whether in broad daylight or at nighttime, for fear that it would terrify citizens or subjects on the street if they saw people carrying weapons. Now, the significance of that statute lies in the fact that in England it was understood that the government had authority to regulate any arms, any weapons that people might carry. In 1686, the King's Bench interpreted that statute in Sir John King's case and upheld the statute. 350 years later, when a person happened to be walking down the street carrying some weapons, and that person was punished in accordance with that 1328 statute, prohibiting people from carrying weapons down the street. Those two acts then help to explain the nature of English law as America is beginning to find its wheels during the colonial period in the late 17th century. And it's meaningful because, of course, America inherits its legal system from England, naturally, because we were a colony for so many years. In the American colonies, we find that there were a number of statutes governing the ability of people to carry weapons throughout the streets on the colonies. And from colony to colony, we find all kinds of laws regulating who might own a weapon, where they might use it, and the fact that they're subject to punishment if they violate the various ordinances. That was the common practice as we moved toward the 1770s and on into the revolution against England. What we had seen at that period of time, now going back 400 years, is an understanding that government can regulate the weapons that people might use. And even though there was a pervasive understanding in America that people had what we might call a natural right to self-defense, protection against governmental tyranny, protection from insurrection, that natural right, however broad it might be, was nevertheless subjected to regulations. And that understanding that government could regulate what was perceived or characterized as a natural right came straight out of the work of the great Sir William Blackstone, the leading commentator on English law that constituted the real understanding for Americans about the law on any subject. Sir William Blackstone's great three-volume treatise, A Commentary on English Law, was published from 1765 to 1769. And there Blackstone is interpreting English law to say that the general right to self-defense and self-preservation, a natural right, is nevertheless still subject to rules, regulations, and laws. That's where matters stood, as I say, as we move into the 1770s and America is gaining momentum to the point that it's going to declare its independence. In the year 1776, the Pennsylvania State Constitution was written, and it provided that people would have a right to, quote, keep and bear arms for their defense and the defense of the state. That was the first time that language appears in any American governmental document asserting a right to keep and bear arms for the self-defense of the people. the Vermont Constitution came right on the heels and used virtually the same language. If we were to assume that what Pennsylvania said and Vermont said would be influential on those who wrote the American Constitution and the Bill of Rights, we would expect to see that same kind of language employed. It's the very last time that we see that language employed, because those who wrote our Second Amendment said nothing about the right to keep and bear arms for purposes of self-defense or hunting or use of guns for sports and all the rest. And that raises an important question. How do we account for the omission of any language that says people have the right to keep and bear arms for their own defense? Ladies and gentlemen, it's a fascinating story. Let's go deep into the Constitutional Convention and then into the first Congress, which actually wrote the Second Amendment. There is a fascinating provision in Article 3 of the Constitution, written by the framers, as you know, in Philadelphia in 1787. And in Article 3, there is what we refer to as the Treason Clause. The Treason Clause is defined as levying war against the government. Anybody using force, taking up arms against the government, is guilty of treason. Why would that be such a heinous crime, worthy of all kinds of punishment, including if carried out by the president and other officials in the government? It would be the worst way of selling out one's country, to cavort with the nation's principal enemy, for example, to retreat from responsibilities of defending the country, for example, with one's enemies. Treason is one of the worst crimes that any governmental leader can engage in, and the typical penalty for treason was death. So the framers of our Constitution then defined treason as taking up arms against the government, using force against the government, or in the most extreme form, levying war against the government. That's very important to keep in mind as we move into the Congress that wrote the Second Amendment. It helps us to understand what the drafters of the Second Amendment had in mind. In June of 1789, James Madison, having been elected to the House of Representatives, introduces the Bill of Rights. And the Second Amendment becomes a subject of great interest among his fellow delegates. The Second Amendment language that he introduces is very similar to the language of the final form, which once more is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. When Madison introduced the language, he took it from the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and it provides essentially that two important points: that the militia that he's discussing is comprised of the entire people. All people form the militia. And he was so concerned to protect religious liberty that when he introduced his draft, he said that those people who are religiously scrupulous about carrying arms or keeping and bearing arms shall be excused from the responsibility. In our modern language, what we would say is he was looking for a conscientious objector status. He was looking for grounds to provide an exemption to those people whose religious teachings told them you should not take up arms, that it's immoral, it violates your religious teachings. It was that clause, that last clause, to protect people who have religious scruples against the use of force or against war, that became the principal subject of the debate regarding the Second Amendment. That's important to note that it's the principal subject of the debate in the Second Amendment, not a debate about individual rights to keep and bear arms. That's not the important part. And in fact, that got almost no attention. Elbridge Gerry, who had been a leading member of the Constitutional Convention, he was a delegate from Massachusetts, is now serving in the first Congress. When he looks at Madison's proposal, he has great concern about the religious exemption. He says, first of all, there is a duty for all people to join the militia to defend the country. And if people are being given an exemption, it may, in fact, cast a stain on their character. People may be wondering, are you not loyal? Are you not patriotic? Beyond that, he said, and this was his greatest fear, if Congress is allowed to determine who has religious scruples, then that means Congress could declare that a lot of people have religious scruples. They cannot join the militia. And why would he be worried about that? Because here we come to the central concern of the Second Amendment. The very impetus behind the Second Amendment was the fear of a standing army. The fear of a standing army had been centuries old. It had been the subject of many writings, essays, treatises going back to England in the mid-17th century. The American colonists inherited that fear. Why was there such a great fear of a standing army? Because Americans believed that was the bane of liberty. That was the great threat to a liberty. And there was a tremendous literature, as I say, dating back two or three centuries, in which writers would say, wherever there was a standing army, liberty would be extinguished. So inside the Congress, there is great concern that Congress, with broad authority over the war power and over the militia, might in fact be able to terminate militias. And that would in effect deprive or undercut the ability of the people to enjoy their liberty. So the Second Amendment becomes the antidote to the possibility of the threat of a standing army. Congress would be given in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, broad authority to train, to discipline, and to regulate the militia, and also to call it into service when Congress has declared or otherwise authorized war. But the great concern of Elbridge Gerry and others was to ensure that Congress could not use its authority to terminate the militia, because then the people would lose their protection against the possibility of a tyrannical government, but also as further protection against an invading army, in those days an attack by an Indian tribe, or perhaps to protect themselves against an insurrection. And so Elbridge Gerry's third point, his third objection, was if we say in the Second Amendment a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, are we implying then that the role of Congress is secondary to the role of the militia in protecting the country? Are we implying that the role of Congress is secondary to protecting the country against an invasion, that we would rely principally on the militia? He thought that would be a mistake if we drew that conclusion. So Elbridge Gerry's concerns about the language introduced with Madison has everything to do with the military aspect of owning guns, of keeping and bearing arms. And those were the same concerns of everybody else who spoke in the Congress. It's clear from the language, it's clear from the debates, that members of Congress were focused solely on the right to keep and bear arms, to join a militia. And indeed, that very last part of the proposal inserted by Madison, those who have religious scruples against using guns should be excused, helps us to understand even further and to sweep away any doubt that the sole purpose was to ensure that people could keep and bear arms to join the militia. Now, what lay behind this? The understanding, based on historical basis, that the militia could be trusted. The common people could be relied upon, because who would be more interested in protecting the village or the colony or at some point the state and indeed the nation against an external invasion? What if Congress failed to carry out its powers efficiently? What if Congress failed the nation? We could then rely on we the people. It's sometimes hard to believe, for many of us, that the Congress was focused on keeping and bearing arms to join a militia when there is so much said, so much written, to the effect that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. Not a right to keep and bear arms for the purposes of self-defense or hunting, but rather a right to keep and bear arms which is inextricably linked to service in the militia. If we had doubts about that, we could look at the early court decisions in the 1790s and the early 18th century, including state court decisions, which were interpreting their own counterpart in their state constitution on the right to keep and bear arms. In case after case, the judges are upholding either the Second Amendment or their counterpart in the state constitution, just as I've explained to you. There was a great case coming out of Georgia in which a man was arrested for owning a Bowie knife, very long knife, as you know. And his argument was that under the Georgia Constitution, he had a right to keep and bear arms for his own self-defense. The court rejected the complaint, the plea, and said, your assertion has to be tied to your ability to prove, to demonstrate that your ownership of the Bowie knife is necessary to defend Georgia. That was the narrative delivered by court after court, upholding state laws, prohibiting the ownership of particular weapons, and also governing the ability of people to take weapons here and there. In a case out of Indiana in the 1830s, the court upheld the state law that prohibited people from carrying concealed weapons. Why? Because, as the court explained, echoing other court decisions, if people saw somebody carrying a weapon, it would terrify the people. What an interesting link back to the 1686 decision in England. Concerns to protect the welfare of the people, not only to protect their safety, but essentially their psychological well-being so that they don't have to see somebody pull a weapon or see it concealed under a suit coat or a long coat. Where do we derive the idea that, in fact, the Second Amendment is about the right of individuals to keep and bear arms for their own self-defense? We can understand why people would want to defend themselves, and state after state passed laws allowing people to own weapons to protect themselves. It's just that that claim is not grounded in the Second Amendment. State laws can provide for the right or the privilege of people to keep and bear arms, but there's nobody asserting that that's grounded in the Second Amendment. Second Amendment is all linked to service in the militia. Is that satisfactory? It seemed to be satisfactory until the Heller case in 2008, when, as I say, the Supreme Court flipped the script following the decision by Attorney General John Ashcroft to assert that there is a right to keep and bear arms as a matter of individual right. Let's look at the Heller decision. We're sweeping over a lot of history, but let's look at the Heller decision for a moment. The District of Columbia had passed a law banning ownership of handguns. There had been many, many murders in the nation's capital, as you know. This seemed to be a reasonable response, so thought the city council. Actually, what it did was to prohibit the ownership or possession of an unlicensed weapon, and the city council said, you may not obtain a license to own a handgun. So a pretty clever way to make sure nobody could have handguns. It also provided that other firearms in the home had to be unloaded, disassembled, and locked away. Pretty stringent gun regulation laws, I would say. A police officer wanted to be able to have a handgun at home, but he was not permitted, and so he filed a suit claiming this was a Second Amendment right. The lower courts, following the precedents of the Supreme Court, principally a 1939 decision called United States versus Miller, said that the Second Amendment right, going all the way back to the founding, serves to protect ownership or possession of a weapon only if it's necessary to protect the country from an attack. It might have been one thing, said the court in 1939, and as other courts said, hundreds of courts said, might have been one thing to assert your right to own a rifle or a musket in the 1790s or the early 19th century, to run out in the street at a moment's notice to protect the village or to form part of the militia to defend the colony. But it's pretty hard to say with a straight face 200 years later that your ownership of a handgun can be demonstrably useful in protecting the nation from foreign attack in the era of intercontinental ballistic weapons and the like. So whatever status might have been accorded an American wanting to keep and bear arms, say in 1798 or 1815 or 1840, loses its ground as the technological advance of weaponry takes us far past rifles and muskets and handguns. Justice Scalia wrote the opinion for the court in 2008 in the Heller decision, and probably his opinion there was the most scrutinized of his many opinions in his tenure on the court, and I would say the most criticized by some of his fellow conservatives, conservative scholars, and conservative jurists. What is it that Justice Scalia said in the Heller case? You already know he wrote that, in fact, the Second Amendment preserves the right of individuals to keep and bear arms for their own self-defense. Judge Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit, at that time, wrote a couple of critical articles and essays critiquing Scalia's argument in a way that could only be described as very harsh. Now, these two are fast friends. They were both appointed by Ronald Reagan, Scalia first to the D.C. Circuit, and then, of course, to the Supreme Court, Posner to the Seventh Circuit in Illinois. Almost every conservative scholar and jurist that I'm aware of will always say that the leading light among conservatives with respect to the understanding of the Constitution was clearly Richard Posner. Not only was he considered the leading intellectual among conservatives, but he was a prolific scholar, writing many, many books. He's retired from the bench now, writing many, many books in addition to his opinions. He was a dominant intellectual when it came to the Constitution. The first thing he did in critiquing Scalia's opinion was to take Scalia to task for betraying his principles as far as constitutional interpretation goes. Scalia had long been known as a quote unquote textualist originalist. And in his many opinions at the D.C. Circuit and then on the Supreme Court and in a number of law review articles and books, including a well-known book on the interpretation of the Constitution and statutory construction, it was always his view that the language is what counted, that he would not look at the legislative intention of those who wrote a statute or those who framed the Constitution. He shunned the idea that any court should ever look, for example, to the debates among the framers in the Constitutional Convention, or ever look at the debates by Congress on any particular statute. Why? Because he took the view that those debates were not trustworthy, that members of Congress or any group of lawmakers or constitutional lawmakers would have political agendas and they might not be truly representing what they think the clause meant. Far better, he said, for the judge to simply look at the language to understand the meaning of that language at the time that it was adopted, whether in 1787 with respect to the Constitution, 1791 with respect to the Bill of Rights, or any subsequent document produced by Congress. In the Heller case, however, as Judge Posner pointed out, Scalia completely deserted the principles on which he had stood for more than 30 years. Now the language isn't sufficient. The language won't serve his purposes. So he wants to go back into history and to become selective. He cherry picks different historical events, cherry picks from the debate so that he can argue what he thinks the Second Amendment should mean. And it's Posner taking him to task. And by the way, it's always so nice in critiquing a Supreme Court justice's opinion to be able to invoke the arguments of his best friends rather than to walk the plank myself. So thank goodness for Judge Posner. When Scalia looked at the language of the Second Amendment, he said, well, there are two clauses there. We have a prefatory clause and an operative clause. The prefatory clause is what we refer to as the preamble of the Second Amendment. And the Second Amendment is the only part of the Bill of Rights that has a preamble. The preamble, or what Scalia calls a prefatory clause, is that first clause, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The operative clause, the next clause, according to Scalia, is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, what do you do about a prefatory clause or the preamble? Justice Scalia was very fond in writing his opinion of invoking Justice Joseph Story, one of the great scholars who sat on the court. Story had written in his very, very impressive, indeed his magisterial three-volume treatise on the Constitution of the United States, which he wrote, began writing in 1833, that in fact the rules of construction provide that a preamble is very significant. But he did not invoke Story for that proposition. He ignored Justice Story's view on the prefatory clause and proceeds then to talk about the fact, from his view, that the preamble is meaningless. It has no bearing on the second clause. It might as well not even be in the Second Amendment. It's meaningless. It has no utility. Why would he say that? Because it's all about the language in the second clause, the operative clause. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. He says the prefatory clause barely states a purpose. Well, it doesn't barely state a purpose. It identifies the great importance of a well-regulated militia, identifies the fact that if we're going to have a militia, it should be well-regulated, disciplined, trained, that indeed it's critical to the success and security of a free state. Chief Justice Warren Burger, a Richard Nixon nominee in 1969, read the two clauses in a way that made them fit hand in glove. Chief Justice Burger, a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, said, the way we should read the Second Amendment is to insert a word, therefore. And it would make perfect sense. Here is how the Second Amendment should be read, according to Chief Justice Burger. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, therefore the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, making the right of the people to keep and bear arms entirely contingent upon or dependent upon the fact of the need for a well-regulated militia. Burger had it right. But Scalia wants to ignore that, according to Judge Posner, because Posner accuses his fellow conservative of being an advocate of gun ownership, of the right to keep and bear arms, and Posner says Scalia let his politics dictate his jurisprudence in this case. I repeat, that's Judge Posner, not me, saying that. He goes on to point out that Scalia entirely ignores the debate in the Congress, that it's centered, as we said earlier, on the question of whether there should be a religious exemption and whether or not, as Elbridge Gerry said, there would be concern that, in fact, we'd be making the assertion that the militia is the primary defense more important than what Congress would do. Scalia's opinion for the court was met with a very stiff response from a dissent written by Justice John Paul Stevens. This was a 5-4 decision. The court is bitterly divided. And you may recall that it was just a couple of weeks ago that Justice Stevens wrote an op-ed in which he said that we should repeal the Second Amendment because it's anachronistic. It's outdated. It's no longer relevant to America. Very, very quickly, critics, advocates of unlimited gun ownership, were quick to jump on Stevens and to say he's trying to take away our gun rights. Let's pause and ask ourselves, why is it that Justice Stevens would argue for the repeal of the Second Amendment on the premise that it's anachronistic, that it's outdated? Because as he reviews the history of the Second Amendment, the very point, the very rationale of having a right to keep and bear arms so that people can serve in the militia to protect the country from an invasion is no longer relevant. Not in this era of nuclear weapons and ICBMs and powerful, horrific weapons. That was the premise of his op-ed, that it's no longer relevant, we don't need it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a pretty indisputable point, I think. It's very hard to say with a straight face that we should have a Second Amendment right to own a handgun or a rifle or another weapon to defend the country. Very, very difficult to make that argument. But it is Stevens who, in his dissent, engages in a painstaking review of the history, going back to Old English law to trace the evolution of the many laws enacted by Parliament that determine who could own laws, under what conditions, where the arms could be discharged, who could hunt, who could not hunt. Consider this. In the English Bill of Rights, enacted in 1689, there was a provision that Protestants would be able to own guns according to their condition and status. Why? because at that time, King James II favored the Catholics, and he had disarmed the Protestants. So all that Parliament was doing now was giving the Protestants an opportunity to protect themselves against Catholics. Have we ever heard of grand religious wars? That's what the 17th century was full of. But the whole history of Parliament, as I say, in enacting legislation, regulating the use of guns, was all about determining who could use guns, when and where. And there was no doubt that it was a bias in favor of, for much of the history, a bias in favor of wealthy landowners, who could then decide that the poor people don't get to hunt on my land. Now, that wasn't merely for sport, after all. Poor people had to hunt for dinner. So that was an exercise, a gross exercise in economic discrimination, but that's what politics was like in England during the 17th and 18th century. Stevens reviews that entire history in an exhaustive way, with footnote after footnote, to refute Scalia's efforts to paint with a very broad brush, and does make the point that, like Judge Posner, that Scalia ignored the discussion and the debate on those key points in Congress. So he takes him to task and points out that the assertion of an individual right never surfaces in the language, and why doesn't it surface in the language? Scalia had tried to intimate in his opinion, as I said earlier, that because the state of Pennsylvania and the state of Vermont in their state constitutions, 1776, had provided that people could keep and bear arms for their defense as well as the defense of the state, indicated that that was on the minds of those who wrote the Second Amendment. But Stevens points out, we don't find that language anywhere else. And if the framers had thought that was significant, they knew how to use the language, they could have inserted that in the Constitution, in the Second Amendment. And he takes issue with Scalia's view that the preamble or the prefatory clause is meaningless. He said, citing Marbury versus Madison, the great opinion in which the Supreme Court in 1803 introduced judicial review, the great Chief Justice John Marshall said, the court should always assume that every part of the Constitution is important and not to be ignored. So here, Stevens is in that delightful position of saying to Justice Scalia, you have forgotten what the great master has taught us all, that every word, every part of the Constitution is significant. And there's no grounds for treating the preamble as unnecessary. That indeed, as Stevens pointed out, borrowing from Marshall and Justice Story, that the value of a preamble is highly significant. It does a couple of things. One, it provides a window onto the minds of the draftsman. It tells us what they're thinking. It helps us to understand what they conceive to be the purpose of the provision. And in this case, that's very clear. It provides a direct link, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state. That's why we have the right to keep and bear arms. So Stevens' dissent takes apart Scalia's opinion, but of course Stevens is on the losing side, isn't he? It's Scalia who's on the winning side. And what Stevens pointed out is that this turns history on its head. He overlooks, or indeed reverses, 200 years of precedence and understanding. What's the damage to our judicial system if the court suddenly changes the meaning of the Constitution? He makes several key points that are of interest to us, not only in this case, but in any case involving the meaning of the Constitution. The first thing he reminds us about is that the court has the power of judicial review, but there's no such thing as judicial revision of the Constitution. The court's authority to review statutes or presidential acts to determine if they are if they are consistent with the Constitution, is a limited duty. If they perceive the statute is in violation of the Constitution, they can strike it down. But for Scalia to have ignored all the precedents for 200 years and the clear intentions of the framers is an exercise in judicial revision of the Constitution. That's not different than saying, if the court doesn't like the 4-year term imposed upon the president in Article II, then maybe the court could say 6 years, that's fine. 8 years, judicial revision would provide a path for the court to exercise unlimited power. That's one vice of the decision. A second was the point raised in the 1920s by the very distinguished Supreme Court Justice Benjamin Cardozo, who in a couple of key books dominated the field for 15 or 20 years, in which he said, if the court is going to overturn important decisions after 50 or 100 or 150 years and do that frequently, it will cause the worst kinds of headaches for judges because they'll be reviewing the law anew from case to case to case, wiping out the value of precedent. But more than that, if we overturn precedents in key cases too frequently, it will introduce instability into the legal system, completely undermine the value of precedents. And if we ask ourselves, what's the value of a precedent? We know, going all the way back once more to the late 14th century in England, where English courts began for the very first time to order clerks to have their opinions copied so that the copies of the opinions could be disseminated throughout England so that other judges could see what other courts were doing by way of announcing the meaning of a statute, and that that would provide the country, through the introduction of common law, with a common understanding about what the law means. Doesn't mean that other decisions wouldn't be different, but it's going to provide stability for the country, and equally important, it would give attorneys the opportunity to provide some predictability as to the meaning of the law and the application of the law. It's what worked a maturity into the common law system beginning in the late 14th century. Cardozo says we lose that if the courts begin to ignore precedents willy-nilly. And that's what Stevens and Posner rip Scalia for doing. It's one thing if the court can demonstrate that earlier precedents were clearly wrong, demonstrably wrong, then reviewing those precedents to lay bare the errors of the ways of previous courts is a service to the community and to the country, but not when it's demonstrably, when it's not demonstrably wrong. And Stevens points out the best case scenario for Justice Scalia is that, in fact, the language might be ambiguous. He says it's not ambiguous in light of the debates, but the best case scenario would be that it is ambiguous. But even ambiguity of a clause in the Constitution is not justification for overturning 200 years of understanding or interpretation. To put this in perspective, let's use, for a quick example, the famous case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803, in which, as I mentioned, Chief Justice John Marshall wrote an opinion holding that the U.S. Supreme Court and all federal courts have the power of judicial review, that is, the power to strike down statutes for violating the Constitution. It would be as if suddenly, 200 years later, the court says, the federal courts no longer have the power of judicial review. We're going to ignore Marbury and all the subsequent cases that have invoked Marbury to establish and to defend the assertion of judicial review. Think of the instability that would be introduced to our legal system. So Stevens makes some very major points, but as I say, he's on the losing end. What are the consequences of Scalia's opinion? Well, it opens the door then to great uncertainty for lower courts to be guided by the Supreme Court decision in Heller. Lower courts are not given guidance to determine what kinds of laws enacted by states, for example, or Congress, could be upheld as constitutional. Typically, the court will provide that kind of guidance. It's one of the great services provided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Lower courts, whether circuit courts or district courts, rely on the Supreme Court for its interpretation of the meaning of clause and its exposition on how, on the application of that meaning. Scalia doesn't do that, leaving courts to guess, which would then mean that lower courts are going to be under increased pressure to determine how to apply what Justice Stevens, I think, appropriately characterized as a newly minted right for individuals to keep and bear arms for self-defense, for hunting, for sporting. And so that lack of guidance creates a major problem for courts across the land. More than that, of course, it also introduces instability and chaos as far as the general public is concerned, because now the people will have a basis for lacking confidence in the legal system. They'll have more grounds for questioning any law. In a political sense, that further empowers those strong, emphatic advocates of unlimited gun rights. That would be the NRA and others, who would take the position very often that the Second Amendment is an unlimited right. Let's look at that perspective. For all those Americans who think that the Second Amendment is an absolute right, let's understand the great weakness of that position. Number one, no right in our constitutional system is absolute. In the same way that no power, no governmental power, is absolute. The concept of an absolute right, like the concept of an absolute power, is foreign to an American constitutional system in which all powers and rights are limited. It could not be otherwise. And even if advocates of an unlimited right wanted to assert that the Second Amendment is unlimited in its scope, the burden is on those folks to explain why the Second Amendment, among all the other rights, is absolute. Why is that the exception? And where's the evidence? We live in a world in which facts and evidence seem to be in decline with respect to the viewpoints of governmental leaders and others, but facts and evidence must mean something in a republic, must mean something in a constitutional system such as we have. And so the burden would be on those who assert that the Second Amendment is an unlimited right to spread the evidence before us. And one great difficulty that they would have would be to overcome the view of William Blackstone, whom I mentioned earlier, who said in his commentaries on English law, even back in 1765, that even that long ago, the so-called natural right to self-preservation and self-defense is still subject to governmental regulation. So 300 years ago, people were still denying the idea of any lack of governmental authority to impose limits on the ownership, on the right to keep and bear arms. So we would expect those who advocate the Second Amendment as an unlimited right to provide some evidence, to provide some facts. If they cannot advance facts and evidence, then we have to agree that the Second Amendment has limitations. Even within Scalia's world, it would still have limitations. To his credit, he did say that the Second Amendment is not absolute. So Scalia would be up against, let's say, some NRA advocates who assert an unlimited right. And he said that, in fact, there are sensitive places, such as schools, ironically, or governmental offices where guns can be prohibited, if they can be prohibited. Other laws, he said, would be upheld if they prohibit weapons of war, and we've seen a good many of them on the streets, unfortunately, in recent years. So he does provide some limits. As I say, he lacks general guidance to lower courts, but even Scalia admits that there are some limits on the meaning of the Second Amendment. So give him credit for that. When we look, finally, at our present-day problems and our great challenges, and we ask, well, what kinds of gun policies should the country pursue? We open up a real hornet's web, don't we? A hornet's nest as to what might be permitted, what should be prohibited. And those are really policy arguments. Those are arguments that citizens can engage in from coast to coast, across America, to determine, even in this era in which we now hear from the Supreme Court that the Second Amendment extends to the right to defense in our homes, are we not justified in saying that the Second Amendment would not protect your right to own a bazooka? Would we agree? No Second Amendment right to own a bazooka? How about a flamethrower? A tank? A machine gun? Well, we can engage people in arguments as to what kinds of weapons will be prohibited. All of this new world was opened by the Heller decision and by the McDonald decision, which also then applied the Second Amendment to states as well. So we live in a brand new world at a time when many Americans, not necessarily here in a few Western states, but many Americans across the country are hoping that Congress would enact meaningful gun regulations. And on a key point, I prefer to use the word regulation instead of control. For as long as I can remember, I've thought it was in error for advocates of gun control to say control, because no other right is subject to control. We don't say free speech control, free press control, freedom of religion control. The word, the operative word, is always regulation. Reasonable limitations, reasonable regulations. When we use that word control, it gives juice and fuel to people who don't want any limitations, because it introduces a psychological condition, and people can exploit that to say, you're going to take away our guns. You want to control our rights. Let's just, from now on, let's take a pledge. From now on, we use the word gun regulation, not gun control. It doesn't serve any useful purpose. Write that down in your notes. So, I've gone on long enough. I've covered, let's see, 700 years of history. Okay, only a little bit. But I would welcome any questions or comments that you have so as to move this discussion along. Kelly has the microphone, and since KISU is recording this for us, let's please speak up nicely and loud and clear.
Yeah, in today's environment, you basically say that to own guns to support a militia. In today's environment, what is a militia, a legitimate militia?
That's a great question. In today's environment, what is a legitimate militia? That's a really fine question, because then often people will say that our National Guard is really the militia, but in fact, it bears little resemblance at all. The National Guard today is an organization of professionally trained people who are paid, of course, receive benefits. The militia is something altogether different. And it would be, so when you ask that question, which is a very fine question, it's a hard question to answer, except we would not want to say that those organizations of private individuals, you've heard their names, the Michigan Militia, the Montana Militia, and so forth, those organizations are little more than people getting together and bringing their guns and doing whatever they do. That's not what the framers had in mind when they envisioned a militia. It was, as James Madison said in introducing the Second Amendment, a militia is composed of the entire people, the entire body of the people. We would not want to make the mistake of saying that a state militia could make war on the federal government, because that would be an exercise in treason, right? So the role of the militia could only be triggered is if A, we had an attack from a foreign nation, or an insurrection in which the governor of an individual state would call out the militia to protect the people because the power of the insurrectionary force is too great, and in fact it overpowers the usual means of law enforcement, city, county, state officials. That would be the concept of a limited militia. But that is almost irrelevant, I would say today. It's hard to imagine what a militia is in our time. We could understand what it was in the 1760s, 1780s, 1790s, early 19th century, even forward when we did not have a standing army, because at that point the militia would be called into service. So you see how history, as Justice Stevens pointed out in his op-ed, has essentially rendered not only the militia, but the Second Amendment anachronistic, as understood by those who wrote it. It would not be irrelevant, would not be outdated, if we embrace the Scalia version of it, because that stands for the proposition that we have an individual right to keep and bear arms. But I think Justice Stevens was very spot on in saying that it's outdated given what the framers had in mind. Why would we need a militia today when we have the most powerful military machine in the history of the world, right? We would only conjure up some illusions about the need to have a militia worthy of a Hollywood script. How many of you saw the movie Red Dawn? Did you see? Well, it was a fun, entertaining movie, but we don't live in a world in which we're going to rely any longer on people with rifles to defend the country, not in the nuclear age. So you ask a really good question. It's hard to identify the role of a militia these days. Let's go, Kelly, let's go over here and then over here, please. Yeah. Thank you.
You actually opened up the whole idea of whether or not the Second Amendment might be obsolete when you explained that the whole militia and keep and bear arms were hand in hand, because once we gained a full-time military presence, an army, a navy, a marine corps, didn't we lose the need for a militia?
I think that's a very good question. Very nice comment, Lynn. I think that's true, particularly given the awesome military machine that our military is. And by the way, let's think for a second on how American attitudes toward the military have evolved greatly, have effectively betrayed the views of our founders. We don't often think in those terms, but think about this for a second. Americans celebrate the military, right? We honor them at July 4th parades, and of course we do justly thank them for all that they do for the country. But remember, in our founding period, our founders did not want a standing army. They were fearful of its encroachment on our liberty. Today, we've taken a far different view. We no longer apparently fear the possibility or likelihood of the military encroaching on democratic governance, do we? That was the great fear, that it would violate our rights and our liberty. Remember Elbridge Gerry's phrase, a standing army is the bane of liberty. That was a common phrase. But we could always have concern if suddenly we had many generals appearing in an administration, perhaps playing a larger role than the military has ever played in advising a president. If that would conjure up the views of some Hollywood classics, right? But we no longer fear a standing army. It's interesting devolution of viewpoint about the role of protecting America. Thank you. Yeah, please.
I wondered if there's been any decisions from the Supreme Court or lower level federal courts on the restrictions of gun rights in states such as Connecticut and other northeastern states.
Good question about recent federal court decisions. So one thing we can say is that four courts have upheld state bans on the possession of automatic rifles. So the AR-15 used in the tragedy in Parkland, for example, has been successfully banned in several states. No court yet has said that there is a constitutional right to own an automatic weapon. So we can say that the courts, perhaps working off Heller or ignoring Heller, are now in effect exercising their authority of judicial review to interpret the Second Amendment in a way as to restrict this so-called individual right to keep and bear arms. That, I think, is healthy. And on that point, I'm glad you asked that question because it reminds me to address a very important point for many in this country, particularly in Idaho and Montana and other Western states where hunting is a very popular sport. If it's true, as I said earlier, that there's no basis in the Second Amendment to own guns for hunting purposes, where then do we ground the right to own guns for hunting purposes? That's a fair question. It's an important question, isn't it? The answer, I believe, is in the Ninth Amendment, the often forgotten Ninth Amendment. Let's turn our attention to the Ninth Amendment, and I'll offer an explanation for the right to hunt and fish as being protected in the Ninth Amendment. So the Ninth Amendment, as you recall, says, quote, "The enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people." So the Ninth Amendment, again, is the enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny other rights retained by the people. So we wonder, what are those other rights that we have? In another time, we would talk about how the Supreme Court, for the first time in 1965, utilized the Ninth Amendment to uphold a generalized right to privacy. But for our purposes, when we ask, how do we determine what's the content of that Ninth Amendment? Here is a leading explanation. And the architect of this explanation is the late Pulitzer Prize-winning constitutional historian Leonard Levy, who explained it this way. If we look back to the founding period and we ask, what practices were widespread and familiar to the government that the government did not criminalize, we would assume that those were rights. Again, let me put it this way. What practices among the people were widespread, pretty common, and familiar to the government, and the government chose not to prohibit them, not to make them criminal? We would assume that those would be rights enjoyed by the people under the Ninth Amendment. That would include hunting, it would include fishing. But remember, it's not an absolute right. No right is absolute. So your right to hunt or fish on private property is still going to be by consent or courtesy of the owner or certain public lands, etc. So it's not an absolute right. But the reality is that's where we find and that's where we ground the right to hunt and fish. And at the time of the founding, we see many laws in colony after colony and then state after state permitting hunting and fishing in particular places but prohibiting it elsewhere. That needn't surprise us because that's exactly what the laws were like in England, just more permissive here in America. Does that make sense? That's how we can find the right to hunt and fish in our Ninth Amendment, but in reality, it's going to be determined at the state level, isn't it? So the state of Idaho is going to determine where you can hunt and fish, and other states would do the same. But if we look for a constitutional basis for hunting, it's not in the Second Amendment, because the Second Amendment was all about a military matter. We have to look elsewhere to find the right to hunt. Where are we, Kelly? Are we ready? Great. Scott. Oh, Scott has a question, please. Thank you.
This is just a little historical perspective going back to World War II. And there was the Idaho National Guard, of course, which was, in a sense, the militia, except it was all called up and was actually, you know, part of the Army. So we had the Idaho State Guard, mm-hmm. which was a bunch of high school kids, of which I was one of them before I went to the service. And we were issued a old shotgun that was halfway sawed off, a full bore. All of us had better guns at home, but you couldn't but you couldn't use them. But anyway, I just thought that you might want to know that there was a militia, a real militia, after the Idaho National Guard was called up.
Yes. Well, that's good. Thank you for sharing that. And so you had a sawed-off shotgun. How long was the barrel? About
semi
sawed-off. Semi. So it's a short barrel then.
Yeah, it was a very short barrel.
Interesting.
And the full bore, you know, it just, you had to be within 20 feet. Otherwise, it just
right.
Flare out. It wouldn't go very far.
How interesting. Yeah. Please.
Title 46 of the Idaho Statutes defines militia for the state and includes the National Guard and two other divisions. I think they're called the official militia and the unofficial militia. And the National Guard includes those ages 18 to 64. Mm-hmm. The other is able-bodied persons aged 18 to 45.
Right. Okay, thank you. So that reminds me, thank you very much, that reminds me of two points. Back in the late 18th century, a number of the founders were urging the enactment of a law that would require every able-bodied man in that period, ages 15 to about 45, to own a quote-unquote good gun so they could become a member of the militia. So that at a moment's notice, you could run out into the village or you could be prepared to defend against an insurrection or invasion. But the urgings never got very far for a couple reasons. Guns were not plentiful, and when people bought guns, they didn't work very well, as they found, and they were expensive to maintain. So it wasn't in those movies when you see people missing all the time, it was the gun's fault, not the marksman's fault. But that was an ongoing problem. And so that, of course, led to the emergence of some first-class companies to build fine guns, Winchester, for example. But then we still dealt with the problem that a lot of people couldn't afford guns or they couldn't keep them working. And so those facts undercut the idea that America was a country of a pervasive gun culture. We often like to think of that by virtue of books and movies that we read, but the underlying fact of the lack of efficiency in the firearm, the expense of purchasing them, and then the ability to maintain the weapons served to undercut that pervasive notion of a gun culture. There is in the scholarly literature still today a debate on just how many Americans own guns. There is the the view of the Wild Wild West that says everybody owned a gun. And then there are those scholars who have dug deeply into the property holdings of the deceased and the county records that showed that, in fact, people own a bed and a dresser, and they own books and some clothes, but where's the gun? Well, too many people, or a lot of people, it turns out, did not own guns. So, a mixed bag on that. So when you talk about the Idaho militia, we remember one other key point. And that is, of course, that in times of war, Congress, which has the authority, as you know, to take us into war, to declare or otherwise authorize military hostilities, can call the militia into service, giving Congress full authority over the military apparatus of the nation. And Congress still to this day can require the training, the education of the militia, which we now know is the National Guard. So thank you for that bit of history. Where are we? Oh, okay, please.
So I'm unfamiliar with the term. I guess it's a term I hadn't heard of before or thought much of, standing army. And so if you could define that in the context of the original Second Amendment writing period, and it seems to have changed. That definition seems to have morphed with time. So if you could speak to that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. From the founders' perspective, having been keen students of history, they learned that the presence of an army in any particular region or district represented a profound threat to the liberties of the people. And they would write, for example, in the Federalist Papers and among other documents that the Danish people lost their rights and liberties because of the availability or the presence of a standing army. That in England at the beginning of the English Civil War, that's what undercut the rights or liberty. There's our train. It's here like clockwork. There you go, 8:20. Every time we meet. That in England, the Civil War was in part an outbreak of the fact that the standing army was actively under the control of the king, taking property from individuals, threatening their liberties. So our founders were drawing upon that broad understanding of history, and as they did in so many other areas, they projected that attack on liberty in their own time to perceive that a standing army would represent a threat to our own liberties, whether it would be encroachment, speech freedoms, or property, or religious freedoms. In many ways, I'm glad you asked that question. In a lot of ways, even if American founders did not firsthand experience the attack or the threat against their liberties, it was a mark of our founders that they sniffed out or anticipated the possibility of an encroachment on our rights and liberties. It was a peculiar characteristic of the American founders that they could sniff out or anticipate the coming attack or diminution of our rights and liberties. And of course, that's in our DNA now. Americans have that to this day. We fear the attack on our liberties. Thank you. Back to the same neighborhood here, Kelly. Thank you.
I just want to make sure that I'm kind of clear on the idea of a militia. So if my understanding may be incorrect or incomplete, but for example, in Switzerland, what I understand is their approach to military is that each young person has mandatory training during their late teen years. They are issued a weapon, but not necessarily ammunition. They drill on a regular basis. They don't have a standing army, but as needed, they can call upon their population to serve in military capacity. Is that really modern definition of militia?
Thank you. So, Kelly, will you bring that microphone down here to the front row? Because we have an expert, our good friend Arthur Kuhl, who hails from Switzerland, who's going to answer your question far better than I can. Thank you.
I am from Switzerland, but I didn't serve in the army because I was one of the unable body at the time. But basically, you're right. Every able-bodied Swiss man needs to serve in the army. It's actually a well-regulated militia. Let's just define it as such. And so at age 19 or 20, you're called up and you need to go for basic training, about 17 weeks. And the years after, you go 2 weeks or 3 weeks, depending on your age, until you're, I think it's 36 now. It used to be 48. But what you have to do in addition is that every year you have to have your target shooting training done. So you have to have a certain amount of time, and every community has a shooting range. And so you go there and you buy your ammunition there because you're not allowed to keep the ammunition at home. And you shoot your target. So it's a well-trained militia. So that's basically what it is. Now, today, you have a choice because you can also do civil service instead of going to the training. Yeah, time-wise, it's longer. Right, exactly.
And yeah. Arthur, are Swiss citizens issued a gun? Or do you buy it yourself and you keep it?
No, this is a... It's an assault rifle that you're being issued when you join the military. But in many, I mean, used to be able to take it home, especially after World War II. They wanted to have the possibility of raising an army within 48 hours. So you needed to have the gun at home. But in the meantime, you're allowed to leave it at the armory, and that's what most people do nowadays.
And did you say that you may not keep your ammunition at home? That stays in the armory as well?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Any other questions about the Swiss militia? Or any other questions about anything? Because Arthur can answer a lot of questions. Right. Yes. Thank you. Thanks, Arthur.
Is this only the case for men? Do women participate in this?
Women have a choice to serve, but not in the military. I mean, not in the armed forces, right? Mm-hmm. But there is civil service they can join, yes.
Well, are they called up?
No, this is voluntary, right.
Great, thank you. Let's round of applause for Arthur, thank you. Your point about the laws governing ammunition remind me of some early laws in the colonial period and in the early statehood period in major cities such as Boston, Philadelphia, and New York, where people were prohibited from keeping gunpowder at their homes. And indeed, they were required to place that gunpowder in a central district for fear, obviously, of a catastrophe. Some people brought a lawsuit contending that the Second Amendment, or in their state, the counterpart to their Second Amendment, entitled them to keep their gunpowder at home, and the courts ruled against them, arguing the view of public safety. Yeah, thank you. Please.
Yeah, let me just add one comment, because obviously that's the armed forces, but as far as personal ownership of guns in Switzerland, it's extremely well regulated, and not many people have guns.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Other questions? Right here. Yes, this gentleman here in front, please. How about right here first, as long as you're here? Thanks.
I imagine this has been discussed somewhere. Well-regulated. What specifically do those words mean? Who regulates? Do the feds tell the states what makes up a well-regulated? That's one phrase I've never quite understood.
It's a very good question. So I can say that in Madison's time, he and his fellow Virginians believed, and this was echoed across the country, that in fact people should be well-trained, they should be disciplined so that they could be meaningful assets to the militia. It wouldn't do any good if they were not well-trained, right? And nowadays, Congress does have the authority, comes back to your point, Congress has the authority under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution to provide for the discipline, the training, and the regulation of the National Guard, what we would today consider a militia, even though it's different. And so on a number of occasions, the Supreme Court over the last 40 years has heard cases involving challenges to the regulations involving National Guardsmen. So Congress has that responsibility, as it has the entire authority and responsibility over the offensive power of the United States. Yeah. Thank you. Where are you, Kelly? Oh, great. Thank you.
It seems like the states are beginning to take matters into their own hands. Vermont passed a law today, and I think they banned ownership of guns by anyone under 18. Mm. They banned bump stocks, and there was another in terms of mental health and who can have guns. So do you see the Supreme Court revisiting this in the future as more and more states make different decisions and differing decisions on the gun regulation?
That's a gun regulation. Thank you. That's a great question and a timely point. I was unaware of that because I was working so hard to prepare for this talk tonight. But in all seriousness, yes, I'm sure we're going to witness lawsuits challenging the Vermont regulation. You can already imagine that the NRA is going to bring a suit challenging the age limitation. They'll argue it's a denial of due process of law against 18-year-olds. So we will see lawsuits. Now, the question always would be, how would the Supreme Court respond? If the court believes, as the federal courts have so far held, that it in upholding upholding the bans on war weapons, then we could expect that the court will provide broad deference to the state police power. States, as you know, have broad police powers that allow the states to pass laws to promote the health, the morals, the welfare, and safety of its citizenry. So the state of Vermont, no doubt, is exercising a broad police power to protect the health and welfare and safety of its citizenry. We would expect that we'll see lawsuits, undoubtedly. And the question is, when, how soon will that happen? And I think you're right to observe that states are taking matters into their own hands. I think we're going to see a number of states moving to try to ban war weapons and to reduce the availability of guns to certain ages and bump stocks, as you said. I applaud that. I think those are very reasonable laws. Thank you. Where are you, Kelly? Okay, any other? We're about out of time. Any other last questions? All the way to the back then, please. Thank you. These are great questions. Thanks so much. The questions that you ask often generate still other very good questions, so I appreciate them.
Yeah, you said the Heller decision was a reversal of constitutional interpretation. Mm-hmm. Okay, I just have a two-part question, sure. And you may not be able to answer it all tonight, but is that what Citizens United was? Mm. And is this a trend for the Supreme Court?
Wow, great question. So we're gonna be here till midnight now. Thank you. But I was just going to say, if I can't answer them, Arthur can. So those are really important questions. That's right. So I said Heller was a reversal of 200 years of precedents, federal and state court decisions that had interpreted the Second Amendment or their state counterparts as a quote-unquote collective right. The demonstration that ownership of a weapon, whether a Bowie knife or some other gun, was necessary to protecting the country. So that was a reversal. Both Justice Stevens and Posner took Scalia to task. I further said that his opinion was an exercise in quote-unquote conservative judicial activism, revising the meaning of the Constitution toward his own ideological ends. That term, judicial activism, is one that Americans are more familiar with when they apply them to so-called liberal judges whom they complain rewrite the meaning of the Bill of Rights. But we have as many examples, perhaps more, of conservatives twisting the meaning of the Constitution toward their own political ends. And here once more, instead of my saying it by myself, I'll say Judge Posner, the leading conservative commentator, said that of Scalia. Then you ask that great question, is this a trend? Well, that is a fine question. It's hard to know what the trend of the court is because we'll be looking at an opening or two on the Supreme Court over the next few years. My own hope is that Justice Ginsburg will never leave the court, that we'll just surround her with pillows. We'll prop her up so she can't get hurt. So who knows about the future of the Supreme Court? So much, as you know, hinges on the 2018 midterms, who's going to win control of the Senate, and then, of course, the presidential election in 2020. And so often, I might say to my students or to different audience that we look to the midterms and the impact on the Senate as an important voice on seating people on the Supreme Court. If we never had a better example of that, it is exactly what Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did when he refused to even hold hearings on President Obama's nominee, Judge Garland, who would hold views far different than the views espoused by Justice Gorsuch. And I've said elsewhere that McConnell clearly violated the duties of his office, the responsibility of the Senate to hold hearings. But it makes the point that whom we vote for to serve in the Senate can have a huge impact on the Supreme Court, including the trends that your question raises, as does the presidential election. If the court holds as it is, then we see a bitterly divided court, 4-4, and we wonder who is the swing justice. On so many issues, Justice Kennedy is that swing justice. We are going to find out if he's the swing vote in the hotly contested issue involving Masterpiece Cake Baker out of Colorado. We'll talk about that soon. My guess is that he's going to uphold the Colorado Supreme Court decision holding that the owner of that bakery did have, in fact, a duty to bake a cake for the gay couple that wanted it on grounds that there is no First Amendment religious right to refuse to sell your wares to the general public once you hang out your sign to do business with the public. But we'll come back to that. I can't remember if you ask another question or if we've covered. Oh, thank you, Citizens United. I was trying to lead that for a second. No, that's a very good yes. Yes, 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 yes. The fact that in Citizens United, here I was just praising Justice Kennedy. He wrote the opinion in Citizens United, which has done great damage to our country because it's pulled back the gates that had served to some extent to retard the practice of pouring in money in that would greatly affect and influence our elections. And I think, unfortunately, that Justice Kennedy was naive in his assessment that it would have any impact on our political system. I'm hoping that, in fact, we'll see a test case brought back before the court when the current components of the court undergo some change over the next few years. But I think that's been a very damaging opinion. Yep, thank you. One last question. Where are you, Kelly? Are you down here? Bill has a... Oh, we have a question over here? Okay, please. Then we'll come up to Bill, and then it's midnight, so you'll probably have to go home. Yes, please.
What defines a weapon of war? Obviously, a lot of the weapons from World War II were then sold to sportsmen as the Enfield, Springfield sixes, the lever-action repeating rifles from the cavalry was then sold to the general population. What defines it?
Yeah, how to define them? Yep, that's a great question. It's not easy to define. And even people steeped in knowledge of guns, different brands and so forth will argue over how to define a war weapon, even how to define a semi-automatic weapon and how different guns with the use of bump stocks can be turned into weapons of war. That's why I said earlier that those kinds of questions are questions of great public policy. To be, I think, informed through hearings before congressional committees as Congress seeks to draw up reasonable regulations. I appreciate that question, but I think it's very difficult to define them. We need politicians to hold hearings from all kinds of views and voices to determine what kinds of guns are we going to permit people to own and where, and which would be subject to reasonable regulations. It's a tough one, but thank you for asking that question. And Bill, for the last question, please, of the night.
Okay, I'll try to be brief here. Thinking in terms of trends, it seems like the original intent of the Second Amendment was had a communal nature to it, where the community gathers together for the defense of the community, the state, the country. And visiting Emerson's house in Concord, Massachusetts, I noticed that there was a huge leather bucket by the door, and I asked about that, and they said every household in Concord during Emerson's time in the 1800s was required to have that leather bucket there, and it was required that it would be full of water so that if somebody else's house was on fire, the entire community would come out in order to help fight the fire, which was kind of a communal aspect. And it just seems like with the Heller decision, we're moving to more of an individual right. And the other thing that I wanted to mention was the Castle Doctrine laws that are being enacted across our country in different states seems to be an individual right to bear arms propping up of the Heller decision. I just wondered if you might, if is that a good observation or not?
I think it's a very good observation, and I'd never heard about the water buckets. I like that. And I haven't visited Emerson's home, so I'm envious of your trip. But I think it does make your point about the communal nature of protecting the village. Security for a village or a state can mean many different things. It's not only weapons, but it's also maintaining free speech. It's also maintaining the liberties that we enjoy by virtue of the Bill of Rights. We sacrifice our security in a republic or a democracy if we permit the diminution of our rights or liberties, or we acquiesce in the face of governmental usurpation of power. So in a republic, the concept of communal actions to protect the republic take on an entirely different meaning than they might in another country. So thanks for raising that. So thank you all tonight for your good questions and comments. I appreciate your being here. Next week we meet, we're going to talk about Mueller, mayhem, and midterms. So I hope that is attractive to you. And stay up on the news. Thank you.